is Word of Mouth from New Hampshire Public Radio. I'm Virginia Prescott. 50 years after his death, the presidency and character and memory of John F. Kennedy has been revived, criticized, glorified, and polished in a series of television specials, articles, and at least one extraordinary radio special you'll be hearing tomorrow on NHPR. With each new retrospective comes a retooling of the Kennedy myths, those pictures of the sprawling family and their giant smiles, their privilege, and no-holds-barred ambition. Here's Washington journalist and pundit Joseph Alsop from We Knew John Kennedy. It's a collection of never-before-heard audio from the Kennedy Library, produced by PRX.
I once asked him what was the real ticket of admission to the so-called Senate Club. He gave that wry grin of his, and he said that he'd often thought about the problem, and he finally concluded that the ticket of admission was being willing to make deals that you ought to be ashamed of without the smallest sign of shame.
What made this guileful and charming man, this second-born son who was not chosen by his father to succeed him, this prolific philanderer, this politician who operated with grit and cunning? Carrie Beecham is author of Joseph P. Kennedy Presents, His Hollywood Years. She's done a great deal of research on Joe Kennedy and the Kennedy family and dispels some of the popular Kennedy myths. Carrie, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Thank you.
You have done a lot of research on Joe Kennedy Sr. and his time on Hollywood, where he made a lot of money. That's one of the first things that I'd heard about Joe Kennedy, that he made a fortune in banking and maybe bootlegging. But it was Hollywood?
Well, it really was. He arrived in 1926 with about $1 million and worth about $1 million. And he left 4 years later with at least $15 million. So that really was the foundation of what will become the Kennedy family fortune. He's the only man to have ever run three studios simultaneously.
Why do you think he jumped on the Hollywood bandwagon?
Well, he was always incredibly prescient for wherever money was being made. And he came to Hollywood at a time when silence were about to change to sound. And he was instrumental in helping bring Wall Street onto the boards of Hollywood corporations and really creating the blueprint for the Hollywood that we have today.
You portray the kind of paradox of Joe's relationship with his family. First of all, his control, a kind of domination that was inescapable, but also an incredible affection. And he was, in fact, the parent who was more affectionate, certainly, than Rose.
He was the hugger. He was the one who made it clear to them that there was an unconditional love. He had certain standards, absolutely, and had very strong expectations. But he was the one who picked them up when they were down, who they knew would be there for them no matter what the situation was.
And those strong expectations were pretty much set on Joe Jr., who was killed while on mission as a naval pilot. Now, what did that focus on Big Brother Joe, the firstborn, allow for Jack, the secondborn?
It really gave Jack that first 27 years of being in more of an observation post. Jack definitely had trouble knowing that this older brother of his, or he grappled with the idea that this older brother of his, who was so accomplished, who was so following in everything his father wanted him to do. He graduated from Harvard. He got A's in everything. He was top of his class at Choate. Jack watched this older brother and felt, well, I can't compete, so what am I going to go do? And what am I going to be known for? But in the process, Jack became very much his own man. The other major impact on Jack, I think, was the fact that by the time he was 17, he had spent over a year in hospitals. And his variety of illnesses, he was at age 2, he was in the hospital for months with scarlet fever. In fact, at age 2 was the first time he was given last rites, one of the 5 times he would be given last rites over the course of his life, which is pretty amazing in and of itself. Mm. It also taught him that his father was going to be there at the hospital bed. But the biggest result of spending that much time in the hospital was that Jack became an incredible reader, a lover of history, a critical thinker in the process. And the other major impact of spending so much time in hospitals and with doctors who never could quite figure out what was wrong with him at various points was that Jack became a real questioner of authority and a questioner of the experts. If the experts don't know, then why am I listening to them? Which, of course, if you trace it on out to its logical conclusion, I mean, probably played a huge role in things like the Cuban Missile Crisis, where he didn't believe the experts, the experts being the people who, from the Army and the Navy, who were telling him to go in and bomb and get those, you know, go in and get those missiles. And Jack had the strength to stand up and question those experts, too.
Which is so interesting, because one might think, you know, having spent so much time being ill, confidence would not be something that you would sally forth with. But account after account talks of his incredible confidence. Do you think it was real?
Well, I think it was. It's confidence. But it also is that result of when someone has had that kind of illness, you get that sense of, well, I might as well live for today. And I might as well enjoy the hell out of today. Because who knows what tomorrow's going to bring.
We're talking with Carrie Beacham, author of Joseph P. Kennedy Presents, His Hollywood Years. She's done a great deal of research on the Kennedy family, and especially on JFK's father, as he was amassing power and influence in America's lucrative entertainment industry. We're talking about some of the formative experiences of Jack Kennedy's life, but he was never supposed to be the one. He did fit the role perfectly, though, maybe more than Joe Jr. could have. How and why was that, do you think?
In retrospect, we can see that we can think that Jack was the natural. But at the time, when you read the letters of Joe Jr. Back home from Europe and you read Jack's letters, you see this incredible difference in the two of them growing. And particularly, for instance, when Joe Jr. goes to Germany in 33, 34, and he says, oh, what a wonderful spirit of camaraderie you feel in this country. And yes, of course, it's too bad what they're doing with the Jewish professors, but, oh, people are so excited, and it's so wonderful to see all these brown shirts. And you just get shivers reading these letters. And then you read letters from Jack from Germany 2 years later, and he says, well, I was planning to spend a week here, but this place gives me the creeps. I'm out of here.
Mm-hmm. And
a gut reaction, you know, a gut reaction and a sureness of his reaction.
Many people have claimed that Joe Sr. bought Jack his seat in Congress, the Senate, and ultimately the presidency. How did Joe Sr. influence or prepare Jack for his political career?
Well, he backed him, but, you know, Joe, he could certainly and certainly opened up the coffers. I mean, when you look at the presidential campaign, it was Joe Sr. who bought the airplane that allowed Jack to fly all over the place, for a very tangible example. And he certainly paid, as he would joke and say, well, I don't want to pay it, you know, an extra dollar for it that I have to. But he paid millions of dollars. That was fine. But Joe couldn't be the one standing at the gates of the factories shaking hands at 6 in the morning or at the subways at 6 p.m. And Jack just went out there and gave it its all. And when you realize that he was a man standing on his feet for 12, 14 hours a day campaigning, and he was probably in pain almost all of that time, his back and the other illnesses that he suffered, it's an incredible physical feat that he got through the rigors of campaigning.
So you know so much about Joe's time in Hollywood. I just wonder about him as a kind of star maker. I mean, he was in charge of creating those mythical characters that rose up in the 1930s and the early talkies.
Joe didn't really create stars. Joe created the studios and stood back and let the other people do that. Joe was the one, he always had his eye on the balance sheet, and that's where he focused. He didn't create the stars. However, Joe was incredibly attuned to what made stars. And he learned in Hollywood and saw how stars were created and how stars were covered. And when he arrives as the ambassador to England, he has arranged press-wise for all these cameras to be there. The coverage that he received as ambassador is a real testimony to what he had learned in Hollywood. And so his children were raised. Now, Jack, of course, by then is at Harvard, but his children are raised with cameras in their face. just the same as children of stars today are used to the paparazzi. That's what the Kennedy children were raised with.
Carrie Beecham, how about the sins of the father carried on through the son? Of course, we know now about the compulsive, some would even say reckless womanizing that John F. Kennedy partook of secretly behind the scenes at the White House. His father, I guess, was also a philanderer. Is that true?
Is it reckless? Is it absolute? I mean, all those things, of course, are true. And the children, I think, were raised in many ways being aware of that. I mean, Jack certainly was. I mean, the parents, Joe and Rose, not only had separate bedrooms at home, but when they were both in New York, they would stay at separate hotels.
Here's Marietta Lee. She is a Democratic operative from this special, We Knew John Kennedy, this collection of audio from the Kennedy Library.
I had the feeling that he viewed women, especially pretty women, as objects.
Marietta Tree, a prominent socialite and Democratic activist, later served as a Kennedy appointee at the United Nations.
I think he enjoyed them and was extremely interested in them. But I felt all along that he didn't view himself as a friend or companion of women. And, of course, there have been many stories about his being suddenly struck by a woman's charms and wanting to leave a party where he met somebody who was beautiful right away and go off and see her more. He was very direct.
That, again, is from the special, the PRX special, We Knew John Kennedy. Carrie Beecham, I wonder what you think when you hear that. You know so much about the Kennedy family, have spent so much time with them in your own way, but you've also written an awful lot about women in Hollywood, and I wonder how you, as a woman looking at women in Hollywood, think of the way that Joe Sr. and Jack treated women.
Well, you want to understand. I mean, my urge is to always get in and figure out the whys and wherefores of that. And I talked to a variety of women who knew both Jack and then spoke to Joan Fontaine, who knew Joe, and was able to ask Joan, what was it about him that drew you to him? And why, when you knew better, you know? And she said, oh, he had a way of making you feel like you were not only the only woman in the room, you were the only woman in the world. That was Joe Sr., and I think, you know, Jack obviously had that same trait.
Carrie Beecham, I want to thank you for your time today.
Thank you.
Carrie Beecham, former private eye, historian, documentary filmmaker, and resident scholar of the Mary Pickford Foundation. She's also author of Joseph P. Kennedy Presents, His Hollywood Years. Carrie frequently writes for Vanity Fair, which reprinted two of her articles on the Kennedy family to coincide with the 50th anniversary of JFK's assassination. There's a link for you to read them on our website, wordofmouthradio.org. And don't miss We Knew John Kennedy, a pretty extraordinary special from PRX that's airing right here on New Hampshire Public Radio at 3. That's Friday at 3 on NHPR.